cloudy skies at 80 degrees. Welcome to this Wednesday edition of Closer Look. I'm Rose Scott. Let's talk solar. According to the Solar Foundation's 2016 Solar Job Census, the Atlanta area employed nearly 2,500 solar jobs. Overall, nearly 4,000 total in the state of Georgia. Now, maybe that doesn't sound like a big deal, but it was a 23% increase from 2015. Last year, solar jobs grew in 44 states, and that includes Georgia. But could that trend take a downward spiral based on a major decision expected this week? Here's a concern. The International Trade Commission is expected to make recommendations regarding tariffs, putting tariffs on all imported solar products, or some. We'll get that cleared up. And if it happens, some industry analysts say nearly one-third of the nation's solar jobs will be gone. Well, joining me in studio with this side of the issue is James Marlowe from Radiant Solar. Thanks for coming in and taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it's great to be here. I'm a big fan of your show and happy to be with you.
Appreciate it. Let's talk solar. How long have you been in the solar industry?
Well, I just celebrated my 10th anniversary. On Labor Day 10 years ago, I made a decision and a commitment to go in the solar industry and have had a lot of exciting opportunities during that time frame.
What was the competition like 10 years ago?
Well, there wasn't really a market here. There were four people that were trying to make a living in the solar business. And over the years, with some favorable policy and some leadership from the Public Service Commission, some leadership from our utilities and Georgia Power, there are now over 4,000 people that, like myself, make their living in the solar business in Georgia.
And how much of that can you contribute to changing people's mindset about solar? And how it could be important and play a role from an economic standpoint here in Georgia too. You had to kind of get people to buy into it, right?
Well, we certainly did. The most important driver has been the drop in price in solar panels over that time period. In those 10 years, solar has dropped about 90% in cost. So a lot like flat panel televisions that we now see everywhere, when they were expensive, there were not very many of them, and now that they're inexpensive, they seem to be everywhere and in every room I go in. The same trend is happening in solar panels.
Now, my audience is pretty sharp, but you know, just for the sake of explanation, let's talk about solar panels, what they are, and how they're used.
So we're talking about photovoltaic solar panels, or PV, and what they do is they transform light energy, photons, into electricity. And that electricity can be used in large utility plants that Georgia Power or Oglethorpe and Green Power might use, or EMCs across the state, or a homeowner, or it might be people like IKEA down at Atlantic Station. IKEA has their roof covered with solar panels, as well as their distribution center in Savannah and all of their U.S. facilities.
Let's back up and revisit why the International Trade Commission, or ITC, is even deciding this, James. And as from what I understand, basically two solar companies, they're asking the ITC to place these tariffs on these solar panel materials imported to the U.S., correct? Is that?
They are.
It's a little complicated.
This is a complicated issue. It was brought forward by Suniva, which is based in Norcross, Georgia. I've been a big fan of Suniva for many, many years since they formed. And they are a technology that came out of Georgia Tech, and they became a global provider and manufacturer of solar cells and solar panels. And they brought forward this action after they went into bankruptcy. This has been brought forward after they were acquired by a Hong Kong-based billionaire, and then they're in debt to a London-based hedge fund. So this is a very complicated issue, but Suniva is no longer the hometown team. Mm-hmm. They're not a Georgia company that has the right position in this, and they've been joined by SolarWorld, which is based in Oregon. Mm-hmm. They're principally owned. They've been traded on the German Stock Exchange, and their primary investor is from Qatar. So this is a very global supply chain. It's a semiconductor, so it's like electronics. You have manufacturing taking place all over the world and is a pretty complicated industry.
One listening could argue, well, the company that went into bankruptcy and this other company, is it an issue of perhaps, I'm trying to put this in a polite and professional way, is that if they knew how to run their business better, maybe they wouldn't have to ask the ITC to place tariffs? Because if you went into bankruptcy, there's an argument could be made that you weren't doing something right to begin with.
Well, I think they've done a lot right, but they've also made mistakes. The primary mistake that these two companies made is they were not participating in the large solar project area of the industry, which is where 90% of the growth has occurred. They were trying to make panels. One friend of mine said is that Suniva was making Lexuses when people wanted to buy Toyotas, so that they were making a product that was more expensive than the market wanted to purchase, and that is the root of their difficulty.
Now, I don't want to get too technical for the audience, but as I understand it, James, this request is basically seeking 40 cent per watt duty on imported sales and a 78 cent per watt floor price. Now, let's break this down for what they call imported modules. So typically, where are these products being imported from? Are we talking about mostly Asia?
Well, first of all, they're talking about doubling the price of solar panels. So when you talk in terms of price per watt, that might be confusing to a lot of people. But essentially, if you double the price of a flat panel television, you're going to sell a lot less of them at Target or Walmart or Best Buy. So, in looking at the cost of solar, it's been driving, the industry's been driving the cost down for years, and that's been driving the demand. So if we have these companies come in and they make decisions that may limit the markets that they're able to sell into or make bad business decisions, then they shouldn't be rewarded with a doubling of the price by the International Trade Commission.
Where are these products being imported from?
Really all over the world. A lot of this manufacturing, like all electronics, is in Asia, but panels are being manufactured in Mexico. One of our big suppliers over the last several years has been Canadian Solar, which is does a lot of manufacturing in Asia. Unfortunately, all of our cell phones, all of our computers, all of our flat panel devices are made in Asia. And I think we should work on policies to change that so that we do have more manufacturing here. But this policy that Suniva and Solar World are asking for is a really poor way to do it. It's protectionism at its worst.
Do you understand the counterargument that if the tariffs are approved, they actually protect some of the U.S. solar industry from international competition, so to speak, and that it would allow maybe domestic companies to get in on the solar panel market? I mean, what's your response to that?
Well, there's no one that would love to see a domestic solar manufacturing capability more than I would. I've worked hard to do that. I've tried to work whenever possible with American manufacturers, but this case won't do that. In the last time this particular action was held at the International Trade Commission, which is an obscure body in Washington, D.C. that most people don't know much about, it was around steel, and it resulted in 200,000 steel jobs being lost, and they rescinded the agreement 18 months later. Mm-hmm. So these policies are being opposed by everybody in the solar industry but these two companies, mm-hmm. and they're being supported by very conservative groups like the Heritage Group and ALEC and other very conservative groups that are fighting for fair trade, for free trade.
When we talk about fair trade, and we've heard that term for a long time now, and you talk about if these tariffs are approved, states like Georgia will suffer tremendously in terms of job loss. Is that basically the end result here?
We believe, as does the Solar Energy Industries Association, which we're working closely with on this, that we could lose up to 88,000 jobs. Now, the solar industry has been a wonderful success story in America with jobs. There are currently around 260,000 solar workers. I was just last week at our major trade show event, and there were 20,000 people there that live and breathe the solar industry like I do, and that we don't want to see those jobs slow down. We want to see these jobs grow, and we welcome the administration and anybody else that wants to grow American jobs. We believe that. Our small company and our industry here in Georgia, we want to see this business grow.
This also would affect just revenue loss in general for the industry, is what you're saying.
It would probably set us back at least 2 years in the terms of cost decline and compression, and it would definitely mean fewer projects as the price of those projects would go up, and it would mean layoffs as a result of that.
This recommendation from ITC, James, still needs a final approval from President Trump, but it's really unclear which side the president is on in all of this. What have you been able to gather out of this?
Well, I think the bottom line is we really don't know, in that the International Trade Commission had a hearing several weeks ago. I attended that with Commissioner Bubba McDonald, who has been a leader in solar in a big way. He went up and testified in opposition of this. He wants to see his legacy and work that he's done, and other commissioners like Tim Echols at the Public Service Commission, the work they've done to grow this, the work they've done with Georgia Power and other utilities. But the point is that they're going to make an announcement on Friday whether there's been injury. They will then, around October, make a decision about remedy, what they will do. That recommendation will go to the president. The president could accept it, reject it, or amend it in any way. This is an unusual policy that the executive branch will have a great deal of latitude in what they choose to do.
James, let me ask you this. Is there another way, I probably know the answer, is there another way to approach all of this without even leading to a trade war? In terms of the price of these solar panels, is there another way to remedy this? I know you're probably going to say, well, yeah, don't approve the tariff. But is there another way to satisfy, I guess, the two companies and then the rest of the industry?
Well, I think that's really a two-part answer. One is that I hope the International Trade Commission on Friday will reject their claim of injury and that we can move forward in creating an industry. But, you know, I do think we need to work with government at all levels to create more manufacturing jobs in America. And you know, one of the things that's been a big boon to manufacturing is low-cost energy from natural gas due to two technologies. This is technology-driven as well. Hydraulic fracking and horizontal drilling are two technologies that were developed here, and they've created low-cost natural gas, which has been a benefit to manufacturing jobs.
Last week on this program, we talked about there were two different industries that were seeing some challenges, and they were good challenges in a sense because they need more workers. We talked about construction, and we talked about the aerospace manufacturing industry. As it relates to solar, if these tariffs are approved, and you mentioned this could set back the industry 2 years, but here in Georgia, what could this mean? Is there a catastrophic result here?
In Georgia, we have predominantly a utility-scale solar industry, meaning Georgia Power and other utilities are using this energy to go to the grid as opposed to rooftop solar. There's not a lot of rooftop solar in Georgia, so that those projects are even more price-sensitive than commercial, industrial, or residential projects. So it could mean, 50% job loss here in Georgia. So we may suffer even more than places like California or other markets which have higher electric rates and other incentives.
You're saying half of all the solar-related jobs could be gone because of this decision?
These jobs are in jeopardy if they make the wrong policy decision.
What about your company?
Well, Radiance has been a company that's been on the forefront of a lot of new technology. We are a highly technical company. We're around 50 employees right now. We're working to try to minimize risk at every turn. We have a great group of employees. I don't want to lose a single job.
How do you minimize risk?
Well, we've become more regional in our work so that we've now done work in 10 states as opposed to just limiting our work into one state or one utility program. We work both with utility customers. We work with commercial and industrial customers. We're broadening into other technologies like storage so that you could store the energy that's produced by solar. And that's a very exciting emergent industry that we're participating in and look forward to having a lot more work in.
Has the industry here in Georgia, have you all reached out to some of your political friends and asked them for some help, some input, Governor Deal, anybody?
So the Georgia Solar Industry Association and the Georgia Solar Energy Association and a lot of other groups are supporting us, and we've reached out to Senator Perdue. Senator Perdue has signed the letter in support of limiting this. We've been working with other elected officials in Georgia. Once again, Bubba McDonald actually spoke at the hearing, which at the International Trade Commission, they said it was unusual for state officials to actually take the time and go and speak. So that speaks to the importance of Georgia in the solar industry. We're now a top 10 state, and we've got some great utility support. Large utilities like Duke have already sent letters in opposition. There were op-eds in the Wall Street Journal in opposition this week. So there is a very strong coalition, led by many Republicans who want to see fair trade and see this as protectionism at its worst.
Okay, so let's look at the other end of that. Instead of thinking about what the worst, let's say it's not approved, it's rejected. And so now let's look into your solar industry crystal ball. I love to say that on the show. What's the future of solar jobs in this state?
Well, there's only one thing that I'm absolutely certain of, and I'm absolutely certain that there's going to be a lot more solar. Now, what shape it takes, what form, the velocity or the time frame, it's very difficult to know, but there's going to be a lot more solar because it's a good technology that's cost-effective, it's reliable, it requires minimal maintenance. Solar panels come with a 25-year warranty, so that it's just a really great technology, a lot like those flat panel televisions we've talked about mm-hmm. earlier, or cell phones or computers. It's part of the future.
And is there a need for more skilled workers in this industry?
Well, absolutely. As the construction industry has recovered here in Georgia, it's required us to recruit more aggressively, to offer more training to employees, which we love doing. And we think that will continue, and that, you know, we need a good, trained, safe workforce. And we want to see the solar industry grow and not have these policies that become barriers.
James Marlowe from Radiant Solar. And we've been talking about how the possibility of imposing tariffs on some imported solar products will affect the industry and particularly jobs here in Georgia. James, thanks for coming in, and we'll all be waiting to hear about that decision.
Well, it's great to be with you. I'm a big fan of WABE, and it was a pleasure to be on your show today.
Thank you, and thank you for that.
Thank you.
Support for WABE comes from BARC, helping to keep your children safer online by monitoring their text messaging, social media, and email accounts without infringing on their privacy. Learn more at BARC.us. BARC. Monitor. Detect. Alert. And from Theater Emory, presenting Midnight Pillow, inspired by Mary Shelley, directed by Park Crowson, September 21st through October 1st in the Schwartz Center Theater Lab. What dreams haunt your Midnight Pillow? Info at theater.emory.edu.
Listening to Closer Look. If you missed any of today's conversation, catch up on our website at wabe.org/closerlook. Again, wabe.org/closerlook. Also, we want to hear from you. Send our host, Rose Scott, an email at rose@wabe.org. This is 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR.
I'm Danielle Deadweiler. I live in Grant Park. I like the family quality of the neighborhood. I like that the Grant Park is central, the activity of the community. I think I would like to challenge the community to have more diversity, economically as well as culturally. I'm from Atlanta, born and raised, and so I know that this community used to look very different. It was perhaps more black. It was, it had a different kind of cultural flair, and to see it shift and to not include the people who were here is difficult and challenging. Everybody should bear witness to the fruits of a changing community, not just those who come in, those who were present.
Robin Young. Growing up, playwright Sarah Rule saw pictures of her young mom playing Peter Pan, one of them with the original Peter, Mary Martin.
What is the theater? What is growing up? Who is Mary Martin? And always the notion that girls can play boys.
Now Sarah's written for Peter Pan on her 70th birthday for her mom. Next time, Here and Now.
This afternoon at 3 on 90.1 WABE.
And Closer Look continues now here on 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Rose Scott. I've asked you this question before, so think about it. Imagine living in your home for 22 years and now finding that it's becoming more difficult to afford your increasing rent. You're a renter. That's the situation Anne found herself in. Back in 1995, Anne began renting her two-bedroom apartment located in a brick building with other units just off Atlanta's most famous street, Peachtree. Anne's monthly rent back in 1995 was just under $600. We all remember those days. Now, adjust that for inflation, that's just about $950 in today's money. A lot has changed since 1995. We know that. There's new development everywhere. And that, of course, drives the market rate for renting. Anne is now in her 60s. She wants to stay in that same apartment she moved into back in 1995, but that may not be her decision. Now, we visited Anne last summer, and we're going to kick off our affordable housing series again, and there's a reason for this, we'll tell you. But this is Anne. Here's my first question for you. It's not what does affordable housing look like, but what should affordable housing look like from your viewpoint?
Affordable housing, what should it look like? Well, I think you should know what it is you're going to be paying when time comes, you know, as time goes on. You shouldn't suddenly have a big jump in how much you're paying. Of course, when the lease is up, really, they don't have to give you another lease. I have to remember that it's not just my home. It's the landlord's business.
Which leads me to this next question. Tell me about your current situation, how you got here, and how you've experienced a spike in rent.
So there was a couple of spikes. One was soon after I had come aboard and had my first lease, and then a year later it was the Olympics. And my rent went up $50, which at the time seemed like a lot of money. I mean, it was a larger percentage of the rent. Then it just went up and up. I needed an inexpensive place to live. Of course, I was living with a roommate. You know, I got myself a roommate who happened to go to the school I went to. I had to keep it cheap, you know, because I was trying to get started. And a year after I was here, the rent went up. $50 because, you know, the Olympics, all the landlords raised the rent. But then it started going up fast. And until it got to like $735, you know? And I finally called and said, you know, the ceiling fell through twice this year. It was a waterfall. It fell in. And the air conditioning doesn't work. And so, you know, then I talked it down, and they dialed it way back. And then it gradually rose again. Which is pretty darn good compared to what my neighbors pay because, well, they're renovated. But all my windows are new. And that was, you know, kind of a surprise.
So when you first started renting, your rent was around $600, $700?
No, it was $575.
What year was that?
It was 1995.
So 1995, your rent's $575. Here in 2016, it's $1,000. One might argue that's not bad for living in an area of town that is perceived to be pretty nice.
It's gotten pretty nice. There were some nights when I would come home on a Saturday night and there'd be six police cars outside. And I'd turn around and go stay with a friend, you know. And it used to be unsafe to walk around at night. You know, you might be followed by a truck driving slowly, you know. Yeah, and I've been robbed twice on the street when I first came here. Yeah, I had my purse stolen and I caught the guy. You know, between the detective and I, we tracked him down. But it's been, you know, fixed up pleasantly, so it looks nice. And nice people are here and everything. I figured, well, I can tread water if nothing big happens. But then something really big happened in that 1 year ago when I was working on the very end of my dissertation, you know, I was just getting it ready for reading. I got this call saying, move all your stuff in the middle of the apartment because we're going to put in new windows. This is all new. You know, I did it, and it took a couple days getting everything moved around. And, you know, I said, now you're not going to raise my rent, are you? And they said, no. Yeah, we just need you to move that. We're not going to raise your rent. I got a notice, like, in the mail, official U.S. mail, saying that as of the end of the lease, I would need to move.
And what year was that?
That was a year ago. And the end of the lease was, like, in November. End of November, And so I got my 2 months notice, which was the legal amount. But, you know, I've been here 21 years. Look at all this stuff, you know. You know, I just had, you want to stay calm as possible, you know. So I just focused on that stuff. And I let them know, well, I'd hoped to be here to attend my graduation. After all that, I wanted the fancy outfit and the ugly hat, you know. And so he kindly extended my lease for 2 months.
So catch us up to speed now where you are. You have a lease. You did get a lease. How long is it for? And you have a roommate now, correct?
Yeah. I have a great roommate, and she didn't know how long I was going to be staying here, but she had to go somewhere. Luckily, after the two-month extension, and they offered me 2 months, then they offered me additional 2 months. So through the end of March, but then I called them and said, hey, I've been here 21 years. I said, you know, I'm just not going to be ready. And so they said, okay, here's a couple things. You can move to the apartment up in the back facing the firehouse for a lot of money.
What's a lot of money?
Well, that one was $1,300, I think. I'm not sure. So it would have been a big increase. But I started getting some temp work and some freelance writing, which the freelance writing paid nicely, but I couldn't be sure of the income. Like, I haven't been working for the last, like, 2 months.
Considering where you are in life, you're not that far from retirement.
Yeah, retirement. What a great idea. On Facebook, I'm seeing that so many of my friends are retiring. But, you know, I was in school so long, and when I was doing my GTA work, I wasn't having Social Security taken out of that.
So you don't have much saved up.
Social Security wouldn't pay enough for me to take that. I have to wait till I'm 70. And the idea, my game plan is to, I have to work for at least 5 years. I'd like to work for 10, you know, so that Social Security will pay me more when I do retire.
Have you ever been thinking, I have no idea what's going to happen in the future? And are you, is it alarming to you?
Oh. Yeah, it's just, of course it's alarming. I have no kids. I'm single. I've always been single. So I'm on my own. That's the thing. So I don't quite fit in. All I really have is this degree and what I can do with it. You know, I do have to work. When I shift my attention to the apartment, you know, and what am I going to do? I have 6 months left on this lease. And will I be able to afford to stay? You know, will they let me stay in this one? Will I have to move to another one? Maybe find some place, but I don't know. It's a very stressful time, terribly stressful. You don't want to be thinking of where you're going to live, whether you're going to have a place to live at a time when you're job searching.
Is there anything else that you think is important in terms of how you see your life, how your life fits in to what Atlanta is trying to do in terms of affordable housing, and at the same time, development, and at the same time, making sure that there's enough affordable housing for people of all walks of life?
Well, there's MARTA. You know that people who are taking MARTA are doing it. Some of them do it because they have cars, but they just want the convenience. But a lot of people don't have cars. You know, affordable housing has to be on MARTA. You know, there has to be some of it there. Teachers, you know, professionals who don't necessarily make a lot of money. In Atlanta, they're getting the high income, high density perhaps, but it's serving that demographic, but it's not going to serve the people who work here. Basically, it's this. Incomes have not risen.
As we wrap up, when you look around this area, there are cranes and bulldozers in this direction. A lot of development, a lot of high-rise luxury living. There's always talk of live, work, play communities. All of this is going around you. What goes through your mind?
On the one hand, I'm liking the neighborhood because, okay, now there's LA Fitness. It's right there. I can just walk over and I can do my water aerobics and everything. And I can walk to Trader Joe's and, you know, everything's so convenient now. But it's not going to be something I'm going to be able to afford. I've come to really enjoy the neighborhood. I'm used to it. It's become my home.
our conversation with Anne, a renter who's been in the same apartment for now 22 years, but is desperately concerned if she can stay there. Now, when Closer Look last spoke to Anne, she told us she was still in her place and that rent had remained about $1,000 a month. She also told us she was receiving food stamps. And we're going to continue this conversation about affordable housing with the Atlanta mayoral candidates, because they're all going to join me. This is Closer Look.
Support for WABE comes from the University of Georgia in Gwinnett. You can earn your graduate degree while working full-time. More about UGA's programs for working professionals at the Gwinnett Campus Open House on October 21st, gwinnett.uga.edu. And from Out of Hand Theater, presenting Dogs of Rwanda, the gripping tale of a young man who follows his crush to Africa and gets much more than he bargained for, performed in living rooms throughout Atlanta. outofhandtheater.com.
You're listening to Closer Look. If you missed any of today's conversation, catch up on our website at wabe.org/closerlook. Again, wabe.org/closerlook. Also, we want to hear from you. Send our host, Rose Scott, an email, rose@wabe.org. This is 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR.
Well, my name is Jimmy, and I was born and raised in the West End here. Well, I like the community because we still get together and have fun, you know, whenever. You know, it don't matter what day it is.
I see the crystal raindrops fall and the beauty.
Well, it has changed a whole lot, really. I remember when houses used to be here. Few things still could be changed. I would change the corner store by the school, because it's been that building a bit older than me.
If we tried just the two of us, building castles in the sky, just the two of us, you and I.
On the next Fresh Air, a Harvard professor reflects on the life and tragic death of her younger cousin. Danielle Allen's cousin Michael was arrested for the first time at 15 when tough sentencing laws were driven by the war on drugs. He spent 11 years in prison and was shot to death 3 years after his release. Allen's new memoir is also a critique of the justice system. Join us this afternoon at 2 on 90.1 WABE.
Closer Look continues now here on 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Rose Scott. William B. Hartsfield, Ivan Allen Jr., Sam Massel, Maynard Jackson, Andrew Young, Maynard Jackson again, Bill Campbell, Shirley Franklin, and the Honorable Kasim Reed. They all did it. They were elected mayor of Atlanta. And now 13 folks are looking to become the city's 57th mayor of Atlanta. Today, Closer Look begins the series, Atlanta's Next Mayor. It's just me and the candidate, one-on-one. And a programming note, the order of the candidate's appearance was determined by their schedule. Not a dance-off, not me. First up, current Atlanta City Councilman, Kwanzaa Hall. Welcome.
Hey, it's great to be here. How you doing?
Doing good, sir. Let me begin by asking you this. How do you define an effective leader?
Effective leaders, number one, know how to follow. And they have had a track record for being able to listen to others, to direct them. They have a high degree of humility. They have an esprit de corps, the ability to be collaborative, but also to be strong when necessary. And it's a gut feeling that you have on the inside when you know you have to rise to the occasion. And there are moments that happen every day in people's lives. But if you're not a leader, sometimes you don't know how to seize them. And leaders that are effective seize more of those moments on a more frequent basis than anyone else does, and that causes them to stand out.
Okay, then let me ask you this. What about those qualities as it relates to being the mayor of Atlanta?
When it relates to being mayor of Atlanta, for sure, it's taking on the things that must be done, and it's doing things that may not be politically expedient, may not be something that gets you the greatest amount of favor with your constituents, with those who supported you, those who endorsed you. But it's doing the right thing even when people are not looking and even when people will challenge you because it's not what they expected to be the outcome based on new information that you've gained. It also is having friends and continuing to make friends before you need them and having enough of a rapport and, again, the willingness not to be the big eye in the room all the time and actually probably having no big eyes and no little U's. I think humility still goes a very, very long way in anything that a leader does, and especially being mayor of this great city. I think also being willing to listen and still accept guidance, coaching, wisdom from especially former mayors, from those in the community, mm-hmm. from the average citizen on the street, from children. Anyone can help you to be better at your job if you're willing to listen, if you're accessible, if you're available. And I've heard many people say being willing and available. Mm-hmm. And that's a spirit, a way to be as a person. And I think the mayor has to be willing and available because you don't know. You can try to plan your 4 years, but you don't know really what will come up. You can't predict a storm, you can't predict a financial crisis, you can't predict conflict with people you never thought you'd be in conflict with, mm-hmm. you can't predict that your colleagues, meaning the council or judges, will be in accord, and you thought that they were your best friends before you came into office or even last week.
Let me ask you, did you lose some friends since you've been a city council member since 2005?
Well, the good thing about me is I don't really let people get away.
What do you mean?
Even when people might be mad at me, I'm generally not still mad at them. So, you know, I'm used to being in fights, but I don't let a fight break me up from people.
Give me a fight that you were in as a city council member.
Oh, as a council member. Well, let's think about it. The pension reform fight mm-hmm. was something that, you know, put me on opposite sides with the business community and with the mayor, with some of my colleagues. That was a pretty tough one. Criminal justice reform and all of those pieces of legislation, especially the reclassification of the marijuana and of the quality of life ordinances. The mm-hmm. business community, again, was not on the same page. And I'm kind of the business council member in terms of representing the heart of the city. And the mayor may not have been in agreement. And then there have been times when it might have felt like politics, even things as simple as food trucks or other small pieces of legislation that I wanted to get done, and because I wasn't in the stream of moving with other people or moving with the agenda of the administration, we might not have been on the same page. 24-hour alcohol sales or mm-hmm. extending the pouring times was something that put me and one of my colleagues against everybody. So I've been there. Yeah.
You mentioned your district, the heart of the city, neighborhoods, Midtown, Downtown, Emmett Park, Ponce Highland, Candler Park, Old Fourth Ward. A lot of redevelopment, Councilman Hall, is taking place, especially in Midtown and Old Fourth Ward. And as you know, with new development comes concerns about displacement. And I want you to take a listen to this.
My name is Jonathan, and I live in West Midtown. For the next mayor, I'd like to see someone who really takes charge with development in the city, ensuring that it's done in a way that includes as many of Atlanta's current residents as possible. I just want to see a city that involves everyone who traditionally has been here in Atlanta.
For some, that's a message tied to gentrification. What can Atlanta's next mayor?
Many times, in terms of my experience as a council member representing the heart of the city, those neighborhoods that you mentioned, we have seen tremendous amount of growth and change, but we've done it in a very inclusive manner. We haven't displaced people. There have been changes in the new investment that has come on industrial sites. But all in all, we had a non-displacement strategy in the old Fourth Ward working with the Historic District Development Corporation mm-hmm. before gentrification was a cool thing. So we've been doing that type of work, keeping people in the neighborhood that other folks are like, why do you have those people here? I just bought a $300,000 house.
If you're running for mayor, you have to look at the entire city.
You do it
city,
all over the city. So the models and the practices and the training and experience that I've gotten over these 15 years, we can apply that very surgically. We can apply it to the legacy neighborhoods where I grew up and where many of my friends live, where some of the greatest Atlantans have come from, and regenerate them, but in a manner that we preserve and protect those seniors, those long-time residents, those low-income residents who deserve to stay in this city.
How do you do that?
So we do it with a plan. We have done a new design plan, but there has to be a neighborhood development plan that has not been done in this city in the last 10 years. And really, since the downturn, neighborhood revitalization kind of stopped in our city in the wholesale manner for around Atlanta when the Hope 6 grants were pulled back from the federal government. And since that, the 11 former housing projects were not regenerated, and all the neighborhoods around them fell into disrepair. And then when the mortgage crisis occurred, mm-hmm. again, we saw people lose even more property. So there hasn't been a reinvestment. There hasn't been a strategy. In the same way that we've strategically relocated and helped to attract companies to bring those thousands and thousands of jobs to the heart of the city, we have to do the exact opposite in terms of regenerating empty houses, thousands of empty houses, thousands of empty apartment units, and fallow land, probably 1,000 acres of land that has not been regenerated in a decade or more.
We're going to get to that thousands sure. of acres of land because I want to get to another player in all this, and that's the Beltline, because the yes. initial promise of securing at least 5,000 units of affordable housing, currently it's nowhere near that. You've been on the council throughout a lot of these concerns with the Beltline. How vocal have you been?
I've fought every time there's been any development on the Beltline that was controlled by the Beltline for affordability. We just had the recent conversation and debate and back and forth. Myself, mm-hmm. Ryan Gravel, and mm-hmm. others were a part of this with North American Properties and the Beltline. And actually, the developer was willing to work with us, but the leadership at the Beltline wasn't.
And
I think that has changed. And I think really the leadership there was asleep at the wheel, did not have a commitment to it. Now, these are, remember.
Are you blaming the Beltline?
I do blame them. I do blame them because we have created a board and we've created a whole entity that back under Mayor Franklin, we said this group is going to execute it because council members shouldn't be in the middle of it. And we created the partnership, which was supposed to be about this stuff. Mm-hmm. I think in a lot of cases, if we look at who owns the land around those properties, it's been just real estate developers, speculators, and investors who've come in and taken advantage of this opportunity. Now, and some of them are complicit and related to the same people who've been in these organizations. They may not have conflicts of interest. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying the move has been about a market-driven approach as opposed to the beloved community approach that many people in District 2 I've talked to always ask for and always expect it to be delivered upon. Now, from a council member standpoint, anytime I had a development where we could have the conversation about affordability, mm-hmm. we had the insert to occur. But if you're around the Beltline, but you're privately owned and you don't seek any city subsidy, you generally have the ability
to do
your own thing.
You
but if you're on a piece of public property, then the kick-in should be 30% or more, ideally. In my opinion, the deal has to work, the land costs. But see, the Beltline was trying to fund itself out of these sales, mm-hmm. out of these deals. So the developer says, I won't pay that much if you're going to make me do affordable.
Well, okay.
And that's where the rub has been, because the land, the benefit to our citizens should be greater, even if we have to take less on the land costs so that we can provide more for those who need affordability. And affordability comes at different price points and by neighborhood is a different level.
Absolutely.
Right? You know what I'm saying? And near transit is a different level.
Okay, but with you mentioned these thousands of acres of land. Can the city afford to buy up this land you're talking about? And also, where is this
okay,
land?
Okay, so I've described this before in many sessions. You'll hear other candidates trying to talk about it now. But there's 400 acres that Atlanta Housing Authority owns, at least 400 plus. Mm-hmm. And then there's the surrounding land around that. So let's just make that a double number. Or even make it 1,000 acres, okay, between AHA and surrounding. Then you have Atlanta Public School, board properties that there's still a deed conversation about. There's Fulton County property, the state property, and then there's other city parcels that we've begun a conversation about. Then, you take it a step further, you have private sector investors who have wholesale numbers of houses and lots and apartments. You have banks and financial institutions who are holding, this is the wealth of the wicked being held up, because there's families and children who could be living in neighborhoods all west of Northside Drive, south of downtown, that have not been able to move back in these neighborhoods in 8-10 years.
Well, the banks and private sectors, they are in the business of making money.
Yeah, but if they're doing business in this city, when I'm mayor in a couple of months, we're going to have that conversation, because I've helped every last one of them. With all of the investment that's happened in District 2, there's no way on earth over my dead body I will allow us not to force these organizations to work with us in a manner that we can regenerate neighborhoods and provide for the 20, 30,000 people who need to be living in our city
That's a lot of units, additional units, affordable housing units. And you are vowing, as if you are elected mayor, that you can bring that.
Yes. Now, let me tell you how you do it. There are people who've been sitting on the sidelines for the last 10 years who know how to do it. M. Tamanika Youngblood helped to lead the revitalization of the old Fourth Ward, primarily single-family and adaptive reuse of historic buildings. Hattie Dorsey, former head of ANDP. She knows what she's doing. She's done on quite a number of units as well. Egbert Perry, done thousands of units. Hasn't been in the equation.
Okay, now wait a minute.
Noel
now.
Khalil hasn't been in the equation.
Stop.
Yes, go ahead.
You mentioned Mr. Perry, part of the Integral Group, correct?
Yes.
Isn't he being sued by the Atlanta Housing Authority?
You know, sometimes in Atlanta.
He says yes or no.
No, there is some suit there. And, you know, I'm not in that suit. But what I'm saying is sometimes in Atlanta, we play these games amongst ourselves. I'm about doing what we should be doing right. If there's an issue with them, the previous partnership that existed with AHA, what I'm trying to say is that organization knows how to do and deliver the product that we're talking about. There are much smaller entities who could do onesie-twosies, but no one has done the wholesale number that they've done. And we need to recruit nationally and internationally the investors, the developers, and partners who want to be a part of this billion-dollar reinvestment and neighborhood legacy revitalization program that I'm going to roll out.
Okay. All right. I want to move on. And why are you talking so loud?
I have the headphones on.
You got me excited.
But no, I had the headphones on. You know, when I was a kid, my parents would have me listen to Stevie Wonder, and, you know, I would just start screaming the song out, "Do I Do?" You know?
Don't.
No, I won't sing. I promise.
Earlier this year.
You don't know that song.
I do know that song. Earlier this year, Councilman Hall, you stated during a candidate forum, you were, quote, not totally sold on global warming. Now, do you want to walk back any of that, or do you want to clear it up, what you were trying to say, or you misquoted? Because I have you as saying, quote, "I'm not totally sold on global warming."
I think you called me about three times about this one.
And you never gave me an answer.
You know, and I said, climate change is real. I'm a science background person, and we've taken an initiative that no one else has done. We passed legislation where our city will be 100% clean energy by 2025, and the broader Atlanta will be that by 2035. No one else has done this. In all the time that people have been elected, we got it right. And we're going to take it a step further. We're going to make Atlanta the Motown of clean energy. I see tens of thousands of jobs, high-paying jobs, $17 to $36 a year, that do not require a college degree. So this is the future that is already in front of us. You might make a gaffe or a mistake in a forum. I mean, you imagine we got 13 people on the program. People throw these questions at you. But my heart, and the proof is in the pudding, when I have something in front of me, I deliver. And I deliver what our citizens expect us to do in this city.
It was a gaffe is what you're saying.
Yeah, it was a mistake. Yeah.
All right, let's move on to ethics and transparency, because there is a proposed legislation to amend the appointment process for members of the Board of Ethics. Now, this comes in the form of a letter from Kate Walsh, who's chair of the Board of Ethics, and it was sent to Council President Cesar Mitchell and the full council. Basically, what they're saying is, look, we want an outside commission consisting of five people to thoroughly review the proposed legislation and provide a recommendation. Now, this would be independent and transparent. They've even mentioned some names former Mayor Shirley Franklin, Emmett Bondurant, and former members of the Ethics Board. Would you support that?
Well, you know, there's some contention around this conversation, and some of the stuff is kind of spewed out there in the news and or in the, I guess, the, I won't say internet, but just people don't have all the facts necessarily, and I won't say that I do either. There has been a conversation about what happened in DeKalb County mm-hmm. and how it has set some type of precedent in this that we need to pay attention to as a city. I do think, in general, we should not spring anything on anybody without trying to be thoughtful about how we do it, especially if it's a shop that they're supposed to be watching. The same is true with neighborhoods. That's not my approach. It did not come out of my shop. It came out of the legal department, who kind of did it in partnership, I'm assuming, with the administration, in light of what they saw over
but
at the
county.
But if
you're mayor,
County.
Would you not want an independent
as
board,
mayor,
ethics board?
I do believe in having an independent board, but all of these boards somehow are ratified by the council and the city. Even when it was created, we appoint them. I mean, every board that touches the city. Mm-hmm. Now, I think the real challenge is finding people who really will be the right type of people to do the work that needs to be done in this space. You know, people time out, they don't want to keep doing it, you know. So I think it's a space that we can continue to improve in, for sure. There's never enough. We've done a lot of good stuff, and I have to say Mayor Franklin set us on the right course, and we just need to keep improving. I do think sometimes if you bring in political figures, you end up going, you could go left or right mm-hmm. because people are still active politically. It's very hard to have a former mayor. I mean, and sometimes when people throw out names, everybody who really knows that they're all on this team. Okay. And then there's other people on that team. They're unspoken team, Cole. They're the Bulls and they're the Falcons. And so we want to get people who are neutral to that, ideally, but who are experts in their space.
This went by so quickly. Let me ask you this as we wrap up.
Are we
up.
Finished? No way.
20 minutes is 20 minutes.
I need more time.
Let me ask you this. You say you want to be Atlanta's next mayor. Right now you have your closing statements. What do you tell the people who are listening?
Atlanta doesn't need a white mayor, black mayor, gay mayor, or straight mayor. Atlanta needs a great mayor, a mayor with a track record for getting things done like I've done in the old Fourth Ward with the Year Boulevard, putting families, children, people first, working tirelessly to allow people to own their own future, bring all types of people of all walks of life together, solving problems big and very, very small. There are no big eyes and no little U's in the rooms I've worked in, and we've worked across all kinds of lines. I'm Kwanzaa Hall, and I'll be everybody's mayor.
All right. Atlanta City Council Member Kwanzaa Hall, thanks for coming in and taking the time. I really appreciate it. Full disclosure, I moderated a mayoral forum last night on transportation. I will be moderating another one tomorrow at the Atlanta Center for Civil and Human Rights. Thank you for coming in. I really appreciate it.
Thanks very much. I'll try to be softer next time.
You're yelling like you cross the street.
Sorry.
That's it for today's show. Closer Look was produced by Candace Wheeler, Ebony Lemon, and Finley Foxen. Our engineer is Elizabeth Eads. Our executive producer is Christine Dempsey. And a special thanks to the entire WAB News team, as well as our digital services crew, because they keep us on the web. If you missed any of today's show, you can find the entire program online at wabe.org/closerlook. And you can listen to Closer Look weeknights at 9 p.m. Stay tuned to 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Rose Scott.